Have you ever thought about that while you're away, your home could be an Airbnb? I did. I actually bought two homes in Albuquerque that I Airbnb'd, and it was just an amazing investment, honestly, because, you know, as you are accruing value in your property, you are also making money on the Airbnbs. It's amazing. So your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
21 Seeds infused tequila is a must-have. It's an award-winning tequila. It's infused with real juice, with real fruit, which means the flavors are built in. It's real. So you need like two or three ingredients to make your perfect cocktail. Hey, you know how I'm always trying to keep my house parties exciting? New cocktails? Do you?
Yeah.
Okay, well, here's something that's going to flip the script.
Okay.
All right, 21 Seeds infused tequila.
Yeah. Tell me more about this, right? Oliver Hudson.
Yeah, 21 Seeds is an award-winning tequila that's infused with juice from real fruits. You only need two to three ingredients to make the perfect cocktail.
Wait a minute. I think I know what brand you're talking about. You know why?
Yeah.
Because 21 Seeds is founded by two sisters and their friend. It's female founded.
That's right.
See?
Sounds
See
like
how I know? Something I can get behind.
I know. Well, there's a good story behind that for sure. Listen, if you love tequila, you have to try 21 Seeds infused tequila. Enjoy responsibly. 21 Seeds, Diageo, New York, New York.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Hi, I'm Kate Hudson.
And my name is Oliver Hudson.
We wanted to do something that highlighted our relationship.
And what it's like to be siblings.
We are a sibling rivalry.
No, no.
Sibling rivalry.
Don't do that with your mouth.
Sibling rivalry.
That's good. Ollie, this was so much fun.
Oh my gosh.
I actually have known John for a bit. He actually helped me write a speech once.
Smart man.
He was Obama's speechwriter for many years and then went on to found Crooked Media. And his brother Andy, who is an actor, we had them on.
I've known Andy. Andy actually, I screen tested with Andy.
Yeah.
Yeah, for a show. That's crazy.
They're literally like the world's most well-behaved children.
I know. We couldn't get anything out of him. Like, no. What did you do bad? Like, well, maybe I misspelled a word. Yeah,
they're like
once.
They were really close growing up. John felt really protective of Andy. They've never even had a big fight. But what's interesting is you would think like a podcast where like everything was like great and so nice would be boring.
Mm-mm.
But in fact, they're really fascinating guys, yeah. And they're the way they grew up and this sort of entry into politics.
And Andy's such a cool guy.
Yeah.
He's such a really cool, laid back guy. And then of course you got John, who was in the trenches. I mean, he was in the White House.
Yeah, but Andy studied, you know,
no, he went to
criminal justice,
right? And then he went to grad school,
right.
And then he's like, hey, fuck this, I'm going to be an actor.
I know, but so They're like the smarty men. They're like the handsome, smart guys.
Yeah, they're very handsome boys.
But it was really wonderful, and I just loved having them on and really insightful. And
you're going to like it. Just listen.
Please enjoy John and Andy Pfeffer. Hi, guys.
Dogs and babies.
How's it going?
Hey, Kate.
I missed everything.
Oh, we might as well just turn it off. We figured it all out.
Someone's on a staycation and someone's working. It kind of sounds like me and Ollie, have to say.
No, I mean, it's true. Andy and I are very similar.
I'm feeling a similar type of dynamic. I know, John, we've met.
We have met.
But have we met?
Kate, you won't remember. I mean, we met so long. We met like 10 years ago.
Andy's when like, I first we actually came. We made love once.
We had a small thing. You don't remember. It was just a couple dates. But no, 10 years ago when I first moved to LA, I somehow wound up at your house for a game night through Michael Kivas.
Yeah.
Like everyone's connected through Kivas.
I know.
That's how we met, because I helped you write a speech for an event that you were speaking at with your mom.
That's
right. You were like introducing your mom.
That's right.
When I used to do speeches for hire.
She
paid you.
No, I didn't.
I just
put my hands together and was help.
Well, but Andy tested for the show. That's where we met.
Yeah, that's the last time we saw each other.
We saw each other.
Like 2 years ago, right?
Yeah, it's a good thing you didn't get it and fucking didn't make it to air.
It didn't go. Well, didn't make it because
everything.
I didn't get it.
That's right. This was the issue.
Look, you know what?
Probably would have been different.
That's how I like to look at things. That's my mentality.
Oh, yeah. I mean, as soon as I didn't get it, I knew it wasn't
going. Yeah, you're like, oh, fuck it. No, it's not happening.
For those who don't know the Fabulous, I'm going to sort of just chime in here about you guys. John, you have been a speechwriter for a long time. Mm-hmm. You were President Obama's speechwriter. You met him as a senator, correct?
Yes, I met him his first week in the Senate. Well, that's when I interviewed with him for a job in the Senate office. I met him during the 2004 convention when he gave the speech that everyone remembers from the Boston convention.
Who wrote that speech?
He did. He wrote that speech on his own.
He did.
And when he won and became a senator, that's when
probably
his staff convinced him.
Contractually obligated to say that.
No, because I didn't work for him then. Right. He had no speechwriter. And then when he won the Senate race, and became a senator, his staff convinced him to hire a speechwriter. And he's like, I write all my own speeches. I don't need a speechwriter. And they're like, you're going to be very busy. You're not going to be able to write them all yourself. Hire someone. So that's how I got to know him in 2005.
That's pretty intimidating, though, I guess, when you have someone who is so eloquent, who writes so eloquently, and who actually orates so eloquently, mm-hmm. to then write something for that guy. And then he'd be like, what the... John, what is this shit?
It's intimidating, but it was also helpful. Like, I feel like I had a leg up because I was writing for a writer and someone who had, like, written 2 books, so I knew how he thought, how he wrote, and he was also very kind and generous and patient with me. So he actually, 8 years working for him, he never yelled at me once, which was amazing.
Wow. And but did he ever throw away your speeches? Being like,
oh, all the time. But it would be in a very nice way. Yeah. He would do that. He would just say, you know, I have some other thoughts. And then he would have like 10 written pages of his own that he would give me and say, turn into the speech. So
I sometimes would think that like any great orator, any person who can actually be good enough to speak it is actually usually good at writing in their own voice as well. I would think that those two things might go well together.
That is correct. Though I think he started as a writer more than he did a speaker, and he didn't really learn to be a great orator until around that 2004 convention when he sort of broke onto the national stage. And before that, if you talked to his staff, like, he wasn't a great speaker running around Illinois campaigning, but he was a fantastic writer for his whole life. Mm.
John, before we get into your guys' childhood and stuff, what are you doing now?
Now I run a company, a media company called Crooked Media. I host a podcast here called Pod Save America.
We know that one. Politics.
Everyone knows.
With our friends.
The whole world knows.
So we do that. We have a nice little company. We're right here in Hollywood, and we got like 20 podcasts now. Politics, pop culture, sports, all kinds of different things.
Okay, Andy, let's talk about you. So you followed in our footsteps. You are an actor.
Yes.
And are you currently working on anything right now? Are you in the audition?
Yeah, I was able to get some decent work over the pandemic, which was nice. I did. I'm going to be on the last season of Grace and Frankie.
Mm. Ooh, fun.
A few episodes there. I did a couple episodes of 9-1-1 Lone Star, and I have a big movie coming out, big Michael Bay film that I did called Ambulance. That's going to be pretty sweet. Yeah,
cool. That's exciting.
Yeah, it's great.
How was the Bay movie?
That was great. That was like an interesting thing where, like, I was up for that movie back in, you know, like January, February, and you know, I was sort of in the back of my mind that this might happen. And then all of a sudden, like months went by and it didn't. And then I saw like that the movie had wrapped on his Instagram. And I was like, what's going on here? I was talking to my manager, what's going on? And they're like, I don't know. And then 6 months later, I got a call and they're like, do you remember that movie you auditioned for back in the winter? Well, you did get the part. They're shooting all of your scenes at Michael Bay's house, and it's going to be one day. It's back on, so get ready, and you're shooting on Monday. So
wait a minute. You shot all of your scenes in like one day at Michael Bay's house.
Yes.
That's awesome.
This was after like totally just putting it out of my mind for 6 months, thinking that it never happened.
Isn't it funny how that works? You know
it's
what I mean?
Crazy.
Like, so you forget about something, and then shit comes around. Like, you know, as an actor, we're always sitting by the phone, unless you're Kate, and it just happens immediately for
That's
you.
That's not true.
Quiet. So, you know, but
that stuff has never happened to me either. And this was the first time that something like that happened.
Right. We're like, oh, wow.
Wow, this really does happen sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is nice.
No, good. It's like that little like Christmas morning vibe. Like,
I think every actor's just masochistic. It's the most tumultuous, like, mm-hmm. roller coaster ride of a career. Yeah. You know, you're constantly being criticized in the audition process. You get success.
Uh-huh. That's just failures.
Constantly being criticized in success.
Yeah.
It's just, you're just criticized.
I hate watching myself. Like, I just finished this show in Albuquerque for Fox.
But I love it.
Yeah, I love it too. But they were screening episodes at lunch. And I'm like, absolutely not. I am not going to watch
that. I don't mind that. The thing that kills me with acting is like, you know, when I first started, it was like, you know, if I can just get this guest star, everything's going to be great. And then you get the guest star and you're like, okay, well, now I just need the recurring and things will be great. And then you get the recurring and you're like, well, I need the series regular or I'll have a failure. And then you get the series regular. It's never going
to
be enough.
Then you're like, I really need to be Tom Cruise. I don't know.
Yeah.
Right.
I don't know if I'll be happy if I'm not.
Right. But then
this whole move to LA was a disaster if I'm not the number one actor in this town.
Yeah. But even Tom Cruise is then thinking, I need to stay Tom Cruise. It's
it never ends. But the sooner you realize how insane that is, like the quicker it becomes easier for you to just take the failures and the rejection and stuff.
Let's start from the beginning, guys. Where are you from?
We are from North Reading, Massachusetts, which is like a suburb 20 minutes north of Boston.
Go Hornets.
Okay.
Go
so
Hornets.
You're a Massachusetts. Ollie's wife is.
Yeah.
Is,
my whole, all my in-laws, all my other family is over there. And then now they're in the Cape. Her parents are in the Cape. So we're in the Cape every single year.
Nice.
Every summer. Yeah. Love.
It's so idyllic. Every time Ollie like FaceTimes me from the Cape, it's like, he's like, hey, I'm just riding bikes, East Coast style on mm-hmm. the ocean. You know?
It's important. It's important for my wife, for our kids to have that childhood, that experience that she had, you know? So we make sure of that.
We don't have an excuse to go back there anymore because our parents, after Andy moved out here first to LA, then I moved out here and they followed us both out here. So now they live in Thousand Oaks.
Oh
and
my
the whole
God.
Family's out here. So we don't,
so
we,
what
we don't
was,
go back to Massachusetts as much.
What was childhood like? What was growing up like? The overall vibe?
Andy, go for it.
Take us down your street. Like, what is that? What is
I was just going to say, we got really lucky growing up because we grew up on this street called Tower Hill Road where there were so many kids that were our age or, you know, a year older, year younger that we were very, very close with who were all like, you know, our best friends. So our street was, and all of our parents were friends. So we were able to like, you know, just walk out of our front door, walk up and down the street and pop into each other's yards and
love
you know,
that.
Hang out all the time. Yeah. It was fantastic.
We're like your typical small town New England.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah,
that was exactly,
exactly right. Like my wife. Same thing. I'm like, you know,
I long for that experience.
Oh, we're all fucked up and I got all this fucked up shit and my dad bailed. You know, I've been to like the Hoffman Institute trying to figure out my shit. And my wife, it's like you guys, I'm not saying you had this perfect life, but she definitely did. Parents still together, grew up in this little small town, rode her bike to school. Everyone knew everyone. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
No, I mean, it was only 20,000 people in the town. We graduated with like 100 people in our class. It knew everyone, super tight-knit community. Still, like, our parents are still friends with the people in that neighborhood.
Yeah,
yeah, best friends.
Was
it
a religious community?
We went to church. We were Catholic, but I wouldn't say we were super religious.
Yeah.
But it was more of a Catholic, like a Catholic kind of community.
Protestant Catholic, yeah.
Yeah.
Very white, middle class.
Yeah. Was it the thing like when someone got divorced, it was like, holy shit, like Miss Elma's divorced from
Miss Elma.
Yeah. Oh, that
I actually can't think of any of my friends' parents that were divorced.
I was just it makes me sound so sheltered, but that I thought the same thing. Yeah, if there was any kind of minor scandal in the town though, everyone would have talked
huge.
About it for sure.
Yeah.
Like, was there ever a time when, like, one of the kids, like, smoked weed and everyone knew about it?
Yeah. I mean, well, there were parties. There were, like, big parties when parents went away. That was, like, the big thing in high school.
Yeah, I mean, we were all still cool.
I know. I'm immediately like picturing you not being cool, which is. I mean, I hate to say it, but white and middle class for some reason is just it doesn't.
Nah, maybe we weren't
back in the 90s. It was a little calmer. I think.
Yeah, that's true.
And did you guys have a lot of freedom? Was it like a very creative home, an artistic home, or was there discipline? Were there rules? You know.
It's interesting. I would say that we had a lot of encouragement. Like, our parents were always like, you two can be whatever you want. We're going to help you with whatever you want and like do what's right for you and that kind of stuff. But there was discipline and they were strict because they were cautious. They were, you know, sort of like careful. Call us when you're out. Come home at this time. If you're going to be late, let us know. We're going to work. Our mother especially like worries about everything kind of thing, which was good because we stayed alive, which is nice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But so it was that kind of relationship. Andy, what do you?
Well, I had a really hard time with school, you know, up through high school. I hated school. Wasn't a good student. You know, couldn't focus or study or any of that stuff. So I had, you know, and it's John is complete opposite, you know, like didn't even need to study and he got like straight A's. So it was just like a totally different dynamic in that sense.
I was the nerd. Andy was the jock.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, once I got to college, everything changed. It was so weird how that happened. But, I mean, I was like a terrible student, you know, made it to college and then became an excellent student, went to grad school, got like a fellowship, all of that. But I think for some reason, it was just like, if I wasn't interested in what I was studying, I didn't give a shit.
Yeah, I got expelled from high school. You know?
Oh, wow. Yeah.
What'd you do?
I cheated on a fucking chemistry test. It was bullshit. Oh,
hold on a second. Hold on a second.
Expelled for that, though. Wow.
This is what I'm saying.
Yeah, but
like,
it's not bullshit.
It's like, bullshit that I got expelled for something that
no.
small.
No, it's not. It's bullshit that you got expelled out of the 9 people that also cheated.
No.
There was nine people in the class that cheated, and you and one other person.
They should not expel someone for getting caught. This isn't the point. The point is that I'm agreeing with you. I was bad. I was not great in school, but here's what I did do. And I don't know if you can relate to this at all. I didn't just say, oh, fuck it, I'm going to get Fs. I would try to figure it out. And that meant cheating. That meant copying homework. I'm like, just the hustle of trying to figure it out. And I think that that is an important part of growing up as well, and something that you can use as an adult and especially as an actor, just that hustle, trying to figure it out, get it done however you can, you know, was part of my education.
How many years apart are you guys?
3 years.
Three. Yeah.
And John, you're older?
Yes. I know, people always ask that because Andy's much bigger than me.
So what was your guys' dynamic growing up? Like, John, do you remember when Andy was born?
Yes. It's one of my first memories, and which is weird because I was only 3, so I don't have a lot of memories from that part of my life. But I remember walking out of the hospital with my dad and us going home and knowing that I had a new brother.
Mm.
And what was that feeling?
Like, wonderful. I had nothing but, like, I grew up feeling very protective of Andy all the time, but we were always very close. Yeah. From the part where, like, we, as Andy was talking about our neighborhood that we grew up on, there was a lot of sets of siblings on that neighborhood, and we would all be, you know, hanging out all the time. And all the other kids that we grew up with would, like, beat the shit out of each other, all the siblings. Mm-hmm. And we just, like, we had our little mini fights here and there. We would, like, bug each other. Andy particularly would know how to get me going. Mm-hmm. But I don't even, like, I don't think we've ever had, like, a major fight in our whole lives.
John accidentally punched me in the face once when we were we were learning how to fake punch because we had watched it on, what was it? Mickey Mouse Club?
Mickey Mouse Club. Yeah.
Yeah. And he punched me right in the nose. That was a good one.
I missed. And then I also, we were throwing rocks in the woods and I threw a rock really poorly because, like I said, I'm not an athlete at all. And instead of throwing it in the woods, Andy had bent down and I just hit him right in the forehead. Yeah. And there was huge gut. Yeah, we took him to the it was a bad thing.
Well, maybe that was what was happening through his high school. He was just still healing.
They're just constantly beating him up all the time.
Now, what kind of line of work were your parents in or are in?
My mother was an art teacher, and our dad was in sales, and he did, he was in high tech sales.
The first tech wave back in the 90s.
Yeah, tech wave. Yeah.
So he was in sales, and he worked pretty hard, and our mom, you know, was home after school. So we'd all kind of come home from school together, all three of us.
Now, do you find that one of you is more like your father and one of you is more like your mother? Meaning, like, you know, there's the artist and then there's sort of the tech guy.
I would definitely not call myself a tech guy.
No.
I don't know, Andy. I feel like both of us are a mix of both of them.
Yeah, I'd say getting older now, I think way more things I do, I'm like, oh shit, that's dad. I'm being like dad.
I do. I'm the same way. Well, now that I am a dad too, I also think that there's a lot of dad tendencies.
I start talking like him. I say the same things he says.
Isn't that weird? Oh God.
But our dad is our dad should have been a politician because, I mean, he was a sales guy, but he's like the most outgoing person you've ever met, would like work a room of strangers, joke around.
Yeah, you could talk to anyone.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, for sure. And our mom is like a little more reserved, but extremely loving, caring. So they were a good mix.
Did the accents, are we accented?
Big time.
Big time.
Wicked hot.
Yeah, because, okay, so Erin, my wife, her parents, it's
crazy. It's crazy.
But her and her brother Brooks, now they did grow up in Western Mass, but they have no accent. How did that work out for you?
I mean, I think we lost ours.
You did.
Yeah,
you lost.
If you look at like old like home videos of us when we were kids, we have the thickest Boston accent.
You're like
ever.
Ben and Matt in,
it's crazy.
Like in Good Will Hunting.
it's to the point where, so I have a 16-month-old now and he's starting to say words. And he said, because he's around our father so much, he says the word car like ka. Yeah. Like he has a little like mini car that he drives around and he's just like, ka, ka. And I'm like, and Emily's like, Mark, that's our dad's name. Mark, you're teaching our child this Boston accent that he's now going to have, even though he grew up in fucking Los Angeles. Like,
it's so great. Yeah. I love that. Everly Well. So, Oliver, I just did this for the first time. Mm. It was cool. Mm-hmm. So, I did thyroid for the first time. I was like, okay, I'm going to check out my thyroid, you know, see what's going on. What happens is a kit comes.
Yep.
You prick your finger. It gives you all the instructions. You put the blood in the area that you're supposed to put it. I know anyone who's has their regular checkups has done this before. Now you can do it yourself. You send it in to the lab. And you get results. So they have a bunch of different things that you can do, right? They have food sensitivity. So maybe it's eggs, maybe it's almonds, maybe it's the unsuspecting banana or carrot. So if you struggle with symptoms like bloating, stomach aches, migraines, indigestion, wonder where they could possibly be coming from,
right.
The Everly Well food sensitivity test will help you find They've got a lot of clarity.
Over 30 at-home lab tests.
Right. You can do thyroid. You can do women's.
I did metabolism.
Well, that's what I wanted to do, metabolism. I was like, maybe I'll do thyroid first.
Yeah. I'm doing all. I mean, I really
do. Explain what happens. So you ship them.
Prepaid shipping label. Mm-hmm. You mail it back to a certified lab. And in just days, your physician-reviewed results and actionable insights are sent to your device. Boom, right there. Now you got them in the palm of your hand. You can share the results with your physician to help you with the next steps and how you want to proceed. Maybe you're perfect, like me. I don't know.
Shut up.
Over 1 million people have tried and trusted Everly Well with their at-home lab testing. It's really awesome, you guys.
Yeah, I mean,
it's really, 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 really cool. Anyway, and for the listeners of this show, Everly Well is offering a special discount of 20% off an at-home lab test at everlywell.com/sibling. That's everlywell.com/sibling for 20% off your at-home lab test, everlywell.com/sibling.
Oliver.
Kate.
How was your week? My week was good.
Yeah, so I want to talk to you about this future fitness,
but
right?
Did you feel late? Don't lie. Did you have a lazy day?
No.
You didn't?
I worked out today right before I came home from Palm Desert.
You're always in Palm Desert. What happens if you have a lazy day?
A lazy day, I'll get an alert from Matt, my trainer from Future Fitness.
What kind of alert? Like a text?
A text, yeah.
He
texts me. I'll go onto the app. And then there's messages, and he'll hit me up and saying, "What are you doing? I sent you this workout. I've spent time curating this for you. Why are you not
and
working
how
out
can
right
he
now?
See that you're not working out?
Because I have an Apple Watch,
and he can actually
they send
connect.
You an Apple Watch. Future Fitness sends you an Apple Watch.
I absolutely love this. I think that these guys have created something that's really personal, and you actually have a relationship with someone who keeps you accountable no matter where you are.
And the beautiful thing about it is you can move your body for 10 minutes.
Yeah.
If you just tell your trainer, I got 10 minutes, they will curate and create a workout for you that's just going to get you going. It's about doing something every day.
Yeah.
That's the biggest thing about staying in shape is consistency.
Oh my God. Body, mind, consistency, and also enjoyment. And what I like about this is they can curate things that actually allow you to enjoy the things that you love. Let's say you like to SoulCycle.
Right.
Or let's say you have a membership to SoulCycle and you like it. You don't like to do it every day, but you do it 2-3 times a week, right? They incorporate all of this into it.
So if you're ready to invest in your long-term health and wellness, you can get started with your future coach right now with 50% off your first 3 months at tryfuture.com/sibling. Again, that's tryfuture.com/sibling.
So when you were growing up, did you lean ever to the arts, or was it always sports and...
I mean, growing up, I never thought about acting ever. I mean, not until I was maybe 25 or 26. I was totally like, I mean, when I went to college, my whole thing was I was going to go into law enforcement. That's what I studied. I studied criminal justice and law. I went to grad school for that. That was going to be my path. And then everything changed after I had gotten hired by the FBI. And then
I thought you were going to say I'd gotten high.
That's what I was thinking.
I was like, this is going to be.
I got really high.
I got hired by the FBI, and then I failed the polygraph exam.
Oh.
And that was the end of that.
What?
Really?
Can you share with us what you failed?
Explain this.
So, this is the most Andy story ever, because Andy is the most honest person that I know. So
this is the thing. Knowing what I know now, I know exactly what they were trying to do to me, and they succeeded 100%. So basically, first I went to New York to interview, and I went to New York and interviewed, had a great interview, got the job, and they're like, "You have the job. You're going back to Boston for a physical and a polygraph, and then you're cleared, and you'll get placed somewhere in the United States." So I was like, "Great."
Okay, hold on. The job of what was your job?
So the job was going to be investigative specialist, which, you know, it's tough to be hired as an agent right off the bat unless you have like a very specific skill, like finance or something like that. So the other way to get in to become agent would be like to start as an investigative specialist, which is a lot of like surveillance of foreign people in the United States that the government wants to keep an eye on and that sort of thing. And then you can sort of become an agent from there. And so I go to, I go back to Boston and they schedule my polygraph. And I, up to this point, I knew, you know, some of the major like drug questions they would ask would be like, have you ever smoked weed in the last 3 years? And I was clean on that. I was clean on everything. But, you know, it was like a 3 week waiting period before the polygraph. And I was really starting to think about it a lot and overthink things like massively, because you have to, your SF-86, it's called, is this like huge application where they dig into your background, your friends, everything. And you can't lie on it at all. And they ask you all sorts of questions. And the polygraph is sort of, you know, a version of that in person. So I go there and, you know, they bring you in and it's literally something out of TV. You know, you walk in, you're in an interrogation room with, you know, the mirror and this guy with a gun on his belt and he's right across from you and they don't hook you up yet. And he starts going over the questions and you're not hooked up. And so he starts asking me these crazy questions that like, they're very simple questions. You know, first he'll say, is your last name really Favreau? Yes. Are you associated with any terrorist organizations? No, of course not. And then he starts saying stuff like, have you ever driven over the speed limit? And I'm like, yeah, you know, we all have, right? And he's like, no, that's not true. And I'm like, no, you know how like, sometimes you'll go like 4 or 5 miles over the speed limit. And he's like, so you're saying you're a reckless driver. I'm like, no, I didn't mean it like that. Like, I've actually never gotten a ticket. But you're saying you drive over the speed limit often. Well, no, not often. So now I'm like sweating.
Yeah.
And so then the next question is, have you ever cheated in school? And now I don't want to disappoint him. So I go, no. And he goes, no, really? And I go, okay, hold on. I might have looked at someone else's test before, you know, just to see if they had the same answer. And now I'm like in this web of lies already. Oh, and I'm not even hooked up to the machine yet. And he's like, so basically I went to Suffolk University in Boston. He's like, so I could call Suffolk University right now and tell them that you broke the school's honor code. I said, no, not at all. No, it's not like that. So now I'm just like, I'm spinning out. And he's like, okay, let's hook you up. And I'm
like, oh, God. Your heart rate's already like 165.
Literally, what he saw on that computer in front of him, he must have never seen anything like that in his life. So he hooks me up, and there's something under your seat to monitor if you're fidgeting. There's something around your chest to monitor your heart rate. There's something on your pulse, on your fingers, everything. I'm like, you can't move. Right. And so he's like, let's go over all those questions one more time. So he's going over the questions. I'm trying to be very honest. And like, my mind is so fucked at this point. I am like, I'm lying about everything. I'm just like, I don't want to disappoint this guy. I have it in my head that I'm going to try. Maybe I'll just beat this test and pretend I'm telling the truth. You know,
that's so crazy.
So it ends and he doesn't say anything. And I'm looking at him and I'm like, he goes, I'll be right back. He leaves for like 20 minutes. I'm left there by myself. Everything's still, I'm like, can I unhook myself? I don't know if I should move. He comes back in and I'm like, he's not saying anything. I'm like, how did it go? And he goes, not great. he goes, what's going on with you today? And I'm like, look, I just really want this job. I think I got a little fucked up in the head with the questions you were asking, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, well, what do we do? And I'm like, did I fail? And he's like, yeah, you failed. And he's like, you can try and take it again, but they'll probably say no. It's on your permanent FBI record. So if you wanted to go to the DEA or the Secret Service, it was like,
yeah,
it was over. They would never take it.
Oh, that's my God.
So crazy. So let me ask you a question. Jeez. This is such an interesting thing. Like, why didn't, what you would have passed if they would have said, have you ever cheated on a test?
You just said
yes.
Yes. I should have just stuck to it and not felt bad about it. I should have just been like, listen, I have driven over the speed limit. I don't care what you think.
Right. Yeah, are you a reckless driver?
Yeah, you need confidence in those. I mean, I had to go through. I didn't get a polygraph, but I had to do the SF-86 and then have agents talk to me and interview me and everyone I knew for the White House to get top secret clearance in the White House.
Right.
It does get to I remember getting to the point where they're like, "Did you smoke weed?" Yes, of course. Blah blah blah. And then they're like, well, when did you smoke weed? Talk about the times you smoked weed. And then you have to start talking about times. And they're like, okay, well, it's just you and a friend smoking the weed. Where did you get the weed from? And I'm like, oh, I don't know.
You're like,
who sold you the weed?
Like, I don't know.
The weed just oh, so the weed just appeared, right?
Yes, this is how they talk. You're not going
to tell us who your dealer was. You're not going to lead us to the. And all of a sudden, I'm like, what? I'm a drug dealer now?
Right, I just smoke weed?
What are you talking about?
Like, I just want to write a couple speeches, you guys.
Leave me alone.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And sometimes a little smoke of the doobie helps me write these speeches.
So after that happened, I just like reassessed everything, and I was like, you know what,
I'm gonna be an actor.
I think maybe this whole time I just wanted to play a cop.
You're like, I'm gonna go play a FBI agent.
Yeah, I think that's probably what I actually wanted to do. So I was like, let's just go fucking take an acting class.
That's so funny.
So I like took an acting class in Boston, and from there it all kind of happened from there, because there was a lot of movies in Boston at that time, and I got involved in some of those and the background work and stuff, and then I moved out to LA and continued.
I just played an FBI agent, a special agent, like literally.
I'm so jealous, I just finished that job.
Clearly Oliver hasn't done any research because he did not know about this polygraph.
No, but I was told things, you know. There was a guy on set. You know, everything was in the wind.
So, John, when you guys were in high school, let's just skip right to high school.
Sure.
It sounds like you guys were like great, cool family. Were you guys pretty much like, were you naughty or were you
naughty? What are you even using that word for?
We were.
What do you say?
I literally picture them like both sort of naked together or something.
No.
Like,
Jesus.
Yeah, but it's when you say naughty, it's like, were you naughty?
Were they good kids? Were they honest kids?
No, we were on the like very well behaved end of the spectrum. There's actually this is before high school, but years later, went to this wedding of one of our friends from the neighborhood, and I was with my now wife, and she's talking to one of our babysitters, this woman who was a sister of one of my friends who babysat Andy and I for a long time. And Emily's like, what was it like babysitting John and Andy? And she's like, it was like stealing money from the Favros because I didn't have to do anything. And then when it came time for bedtime, instead of me saying to them, you have to go to bed, the two of them would say, all right, it's time for bed now. We're going to go up and brush our teeth and put ourselves to bed. Not 1 minute past 8 o'clock.
Oh my God. Yeah, we were. That's a dream.
Yeah, we were.
That
we
means
were,
you're, yeah. you're good parents, kids. That means your parents are great.
I have a good high school story about being naughty.
Yeah. Don't say you are
naughty. What's wrong with the word naughty?
It is the connotation is very it's like it's sexual in nature.
You know, between John and I collectively, we probably had maybe three parties at the house all throughout high school. You know, not that many. But the one party I did decide to have was senior year, I think summer of senior year going into college. Our parents were away. I decided to have a gathering. You know, it wasn't a bender or anything, but I had some people over, and we were taking pictures. You know, back then, obviously, we still did the disposable cameras and stuff. So we were taking a bunch of pictures and whatnot. And I, successful party. The parents come home from vacation. They have no idea it happened. Everything was cleaned up perfectly. It was great. A couple days later, my mom calls me downstairs and she goes, I just came back from CVS to pick up our pictures from the vacation.
Oh, God.
And so what happened was she went into CVS. She said, I'm picking up photos for Favreau. Mm-hmm. They gave her my photos from the party. And it was just, and she starts throwing pictures at me like I'm, you know, like I'm in the interrogation room. Some cops, like,
no wonder you failed that test.
I can't look at them.
Yeah. I actually had a similar thing. I don't know if I ever told you this, but I went to take what I thought was my film to go get developed, but I got it back and it was all of Oliver and his friends just like blazed taking pictures of their eyeballs. So it's just Oliver with like these like big red eyes and they're just like and it's John and like you guys were all
oh God
I think I still don't we, have them in there
don't we all feel lucky that we're all yes. old enough that all these pictures were actual pictures yes. and not just mm-hmm. pictures online?
Not on Instagram. Like actually, like,
what would we have done? I don't know.
Oh my God.
I think about that.
I
all would the have time. Been.
I don't know. I mean,
bad.
I have pictures that I know were taken that I've actually seen that I can still see what they were, that if they came out today, it would be like, oh my God, dude. Yeah.
Like, the thing that wakes you up at 2 a.m, you're like, oh, fuck.
So what about, John, when you left for college, you know, was mm-hmm. there, was that a sad moment? Were you guys that close to where now you're gone? And then
I went to Holy Cross, which is in Worcester, sort of close to Longmeadow. And then Andy went to Suffolk. And so, like, I brought Andy to Holy Cross a few times. I think, yeah. like, the drunkest Andy got, or oh, the yeah, first time sure. he got really drunk, was when he came to Holy Cross and I took him to a party. And then, like, poor Andy was, like, sitting around the toilet all night.
Yeah.
And I was like, what did I do to my poor younger brother? I was, like, a junior. He was a freshman, so, I think. Or I was a senior, maybe. I can't remember.
All part of the younger brother experience.
Yeah, right. But we saw each other a lot then.
Ollie invited me to Boulder. I was like 17.
Yeah.
And I was like, this is obnoxious. I was one of those sisters. I was like, Oliver's gonna like I can't believe mom is paying for him to go to college. Like in my mind, all I was thinking about was like, Oliver isn't at college. He's just partying. That's like,
I couldn't agree more. And honestly, that's why I called my mom first semester of my sophomore year. And I was like, I need to get out of here.
So when you were partying, having fun, which now I wish I did do, is that where you fell in love with this idea of speech writing and politics? And
yeah, I thought for a while that maybe I'd be a journalist because I loved writing. And then junior year at Holy Cross, they had a DC internship program where you could go to DC and intern anywhere you wanted. And I interned in John Kerry's office, who was our senator. And it was 2002. So he was getting ready to run for president. So I sat for a semester with his communications director and speechwriter and political director, and they were all planning the campaign, and it was all exciting to me. So I loved the internship so much that when I came back to Holy Cross senior year, I kept bugging them for a job on the Kerry campaign, any job. And then, like, the night before I graduated, they gave me a job as a press assistant on the campaign. And so I moved to DC 2 weeks after I graduated, and I started politics that way. But I sort of just fell into speechwriting because I ended up sitting next to the speechwriter for the campaign. And when Kerry was losing the primary and he was broke and he couldn't hire a real extra speechwriter, I was there and they didn't have to pay me more than my $20,000 a year that I was getting. And and so I was just promoted thinking that he was going to lose anyway.
HelloFresh, Oliver. Have you been using it? I've been using mine.
I love my HelloFresh.
HelloFresh.
Especially when you got kids. God, it's so easy.
It's the best. It makes it easy for everybody.
Yep.
I can literally be like, Bing, make your own dinner. Bing is very resourceful like that.
It's true.
Bing the other day came down. He cut up some cucumbers, made a miso soup thing with his noodles, did like a whole thing, and came into my bedroom because I was up there just like watching Love is Blind. And he just came up with like his whole, like,
yeah.
I was like, what?
Wow. That's great.
Yeah, he's the best. So Bing.
He could make food. HelloFresh delivers pre-portioned ingredients to your door. Farm fresh produce. It arrives within a week, so you get the convenience without skimping on quality. You don't have to go to the grocery store. You don't have to wait in the long
lines. Quick and easy meals.
You don't have to waste money on have the excess food waste,
which is
insane.
Drives both Oliver and I crazy. It makes me crazy.
And it's so yummy.
It's easy. They're like 20-minute recipes, really low prep, easy cleanup. And that's, I think, the thing that's nice. Sometimes you want to go the extra mile, but most of the time, meal prep is the hardest thing for mm-hmm. when you've got as many kids as Ollie and I both do. It's like,
yeah. Oh, it's great. Crazy. I made these, I can't remember the exact name of them, but it was like a dinner sandwich, like a sloppy Joe type of a thing. I can't remember the name, but everything is right there. I mean, it prepackaged, everything's perfect. You're like, oh, this is so simple. All I need is like a pan and some olive oil.
Super, super easy.
Love it.
So go to HelloFresh.com/sibling16, sibling16, and use code sibling16 for up to 16 free meals and 3 free gifts.
HelloFresh.com/sibling16 and use code sibling16 for up to 16 free meals and 3 free gifts. You know what I was thinking?
Well, can I tell you what I was thinking first? I was just in the desert. I just got back from Palm Desert.
Oh, cool.
And it was like 85 degrees there. Mm-hmm. And I put four cores
light. Oh, cool. Like, I didn't know you were in the desert. You like had my son.
I did. I had your son. But I was not drinking Coors Light with your son. But I was in the desert with a group of guys and I had four Coors Lights in my cooler.
Mm.
And I cracked one open. And immediately we were like on hole six. Hole nine is where you're at the turn, where you get stuff.
Yeah.
Everyone in my group went and got Coors Lights because they were like, that looks amazing. I'm like, it is amazing.
You started a Coors Light trend.
I did.
It is the time of year, though. This is like, we're in the hectic time of year where you're like coming into the spring. There's a lot of activity happening now. Now everybody's like out and about and what have you. And it kind of gets me excited for like baseball and a beer.
Mm-hmm. No, it's true.
I kind of feel like there's always a good time for a beer.
Of course.
Coors Light.
There's never a bad time for a Coors Light. Maybe that should be the new slogan.
Yeah.
But it is made to chill. We're still
chilling.
We're still chilling. And I still love a Blue Mountain. Don't get me wrong. It's cold lagered, cold filtered, cold packaged.
Blue.
And it's literally made to chill. So when I take a second for myself, and I'm speaking for my sister as well, I reach for the beer that is made to chill. Get Coors Light delivered straight to your door with Drizzly or Instacart by going to CoorsLight.com/Hudson. Celebrate responsibly. Coors Brewing Company, Golden, Colorado. How do you become a speechwriter? I know you, I just heard your sort of the way that you segued into it, but you know, what are the things that you have to pay attention to be a prolific, a great speechwriter? I mean, obviously you have to capture the voice of that person, right? Is that the idea?
Yeah, you have to be a good, aside from being a good writer, you have to be a bit of a mind reader, a bit of a diplomat, because every speech, especially for politicians, there's like a whole crew of people that want to be involved. And so you have to take some people's edits and try to push away some other people's edits. And you have to, you know, make peace with everyone. But really, like, to learn Barack Obama's voice, you know, I read both of his books. I went to every town hall he did. I listened to every interview he did. But then I just made sure I had a lot of one-on-one time with him, because you've got to not only know how the person speaks and writes, you need to know how the person thinks. And so you have to get so close to the person that you can, like when Barack Obama is interviewed now to this day, I could probably tell you what his answers are going to be,
right,
no matter what question he's asked, just because I know how he thinks about things. And if you have that kind of relationship with the person that you're writing for, then I think you can do a good job.
And what about just the structure of a speech? You know, I mean, I love to write. I'm not really a structured writer. I just like words.
Ollie's a great writer.
Thank you. When you're structuring something like that, how focused are you on sort of the prose and the flowery element of it? And then how much is sort of the structure of the speech and how it's all going to sort of sing?
It should be the structure of the speech and the story first. Like, I think the problem with a lot of politician speeches is that it's just a collection of sound bites and applause lines that are just like strung together. And I think writing a speech should be like telling a story. It should be like it should be as close to a conversation that you'd have with someone who you're telling a story to as possible. And once you've got the logic and flow of the story down and the structure of the speech, just like a script, you know, like then once you have that down, then you can concentrate on, do I want more flowery language here? Do I want an applause line, et cetera, et cetera? But I think you gotta get the structure down.
Does your ego ever get into it where you're like, ah, dude, I'm gonna write the fucking, it's happening. I got the line, I got the historic line, I got the not ask what your country can do for you line.
Yeah, what's the proudest line you wrote for the Obama presidency?
I can't remember if it's Obama and I didn't focus as much on lines. We focused on like, what's this what's the whole speech going to be? What's the story of the speech? But there was a string of speeches in the primary where, from like winning Iowa, the night that he won the Iowa caucuses, to the night that he lost narrowly to Hillary in New Hampshire and gave the Yes We Can speech, to the convention speech, to when he won the presidency and did the speech in Grant Park, the victory speech. Like every time he won a primary or a caucus or the nomination, me and the other speechwriters would get pretty excited writing those speeches because everyone took those live and they were historic and he got to be soaring. And like, you don't get to do that with a lot of politicians. Since him, I don't think you get to do that with a lot of politicians. And so it was really lucky.
Who's responsible for Yes, We Can?
Yes, We Can was a slogan in an ad in his 2004 Senate campaign that David Axelrod, his chief strategist, wrote into the ad that Obama initially didn't like because he thought it was too cheesy. And then Michelle was like, I don't think it's too cheesy. I think it's good for the ad. So they put it in the ad. And then that was in 2004. I brought it back for the New Hampshire speech because I was like, he had this great slogan from 2004 that he hasn't used anymore. Like, let's try to do it in a different way and sort of connect it to the history of America and stuff like that. So that's how we did it in the New Hampshire speech that night.
But why politics? Like, why were you attracted to politics? And then even to elaborate, even, you know, to continue on where you started and where we are now. I mean, it's just fucking crazy. So,
I mean, I can't tell, like, I feel, Andy, I don't know if you remember this growing up, but I feel like we were a pretty political household in the sense that mom and dad were always talking about politics. Not like they wanted to be politically active, but when there was political news, they would talk about it. Our aunts and uncles would talk about it. Our grandparents would talk about it. Our grandfather, our father's father, was a state rep in New Hampshire also. So it sort of was how we grew up.
Yeah.
And, you know? And then I think when I went to Holy Cross, and, you know, Holy Cross is run by the Jesuits and they're like very into social justice, I kind of felt, aside from like the political gossip that we all had growing up, then I sort of felt a pull to just make the world better, as cheesy as it sounds. Like, I wanted to just help. I wanted to do things to make a difference. Especially like going to school in Worcester, and I did a lot of community service in the city, and I just felt like the best way to do this, the best way to make an impact is to actually go into politics. And I also liked sort of the excitement of it too. So it was both an exciting field and something that I felt like I was doing good. Yeah.
John, I'm intrigued to know, because you've worked in an administration so intimately, and then now, you know, you're doing something completely different. You know, you've got your company, your media company, even though it's probably a lot of it zeroed in on politics and things. What is are you comfortable taking a position on politics? How do you see the Democratic Party that you were in 2000 when in the Obama administration versus what we're looking at now? Like, do you see a big difference? Are you happy with the state of our?
No. So the Obama campaign was something special, right? And we win, and there's all this hope, and there's all this possibility, and we get to the White House, and we have all of these crises at once, and the White House was brutal, right? And the Republicans were brutal, and the financial crisis was brutal. And I can remember in the reelect in 2012, flying around the country with Obama and him saying, all we have to do is, if we win this, if we beat these guys again in 2012, then the fever will have broken. And the Republicans from then on will realize that they're going to keep losing if they keep being this obstructionist and this extremist. And they'll start working with us and things will get better. And obviously that has not happened at all. And it has been hard from that point on. Politics has felt like, being a Democrat, being a progressive, an uphill struggle, to say the least. And look, I still do it, and I care a lot about it, because I feel like there are only two choices. There is keep fighting or give up. And we know what happens if we all give up, so I'm just going to keep at this. And there are moments that you're hopeful. You know, Joe Biden, Kamala Harris win the election. We win the midterms in 2018. Like, there are these moments that, and pass legislation that you care about, right? And but on a daily basis, it is a fucking mess, as is evident to everyone who is a casual observer. And I think that is true for a lot of reasons. I think it's partly the extremism of the Republican Party. I think it's the power of Fox News and their propaganda machine. I also think I'm doing this podcast now called Offline, which is about the internet breaking our brains. Like, I think that the way we interact with each other, the way that we debate each other, the way that we talk to each other, which happens mostly online, is making nuance and subtlety and good faith and empathy and understanding nearly impossible. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because every, you know, there's just like a lot of virtue signaling and shit posting and owning people, and there's very little actual debate about the issues that matter.
And the problem is the issues now, they're so dissected into fiction, reality, kind of fiction, kind of reality. And these algorithms are feeding us what we want. And, yes. and these algorithms don't give a fuck whether it's true or not. And then we're just sort of eating this bowl of just bullshit porridge. And now how do we have a healthy debate? When you're not debating anything factual, or one thinks it's fact, the other doesn't, and vice versa, it's just a total mess. You can't even have a healthy conversation anymore.
You got to get those likes and retweets. That's what it's all about.
It's also just
it's
like
true.
Imaginative, innovative thinking. What it's doing to our brains, and what it's like, what the part of the brain that it shuts off. Like a weird example is, I went to go drop my daughter off at school today. I forgot my phone. And so I'm driving and I realize I don't have my phone. I'm like, okay. Ronnie and I were like silent. It was really interesting and kind of weird. You know, we were just sort of silent. And then we had like a little conversation. And then I drove home, and halfway through the drive home, I started talking to myself. And I realized that we don't spend time quiet. In life, ever. I say that as a zenial, or we're called zenials. Did you know this?
I'm not.
It's that we're a cusper. Yeah, cuspers are.
I'm not that.
Cuspers are a thing, you know. But I say this as like, you know, it's just funny how your brain we don't allow our brains, and that is where, like, you talk about healthy debate. You talk about things that actually. The times in our lives where we could actually focus on one thing and focus on it in a way where there's no distraction just doesn't exist anymore.
I will say, and I'm not even fucking around, like, when I'm in my car, there's nothing on, and I'm just quiet with myself. And
really?
I
just
love
quiet
it.
Space
yeah.
in the car.
I just drove. I finished this job. We were in Vegas last day. I just drove 4 hours. Maybe I listened to Stern a little bit. But for the most part, it was just quiet. I hear the road. I hear the car on the road. And it's just my thoughts just going.
I do that a lot, too. Back when I used to bartend, when I'd get out at like 3 a.m, the drive home, I need silence. Because it's just like so much, your head is just like so full of shit. And yeah. I would love to just get in my car and have nothing.
It feels good. It's almost a form of meditation. I think Bateman does that too, Jason Bateman. I think when he gets into his car, everything just shuts off.
Nothing.
It's just quiet. Yeah.
It's also like,
I love Bateman.
It's anxiety too, reading that much news. Like we were at Andy's for Thanksgiving, the family, and I woke up on Thanksgiving morning and I looked at my phone, as I often do, and started scrolling, and I saw the first news of the Omicron variant, and I started reading more about it, and I started getting all freaked out. And all through Thanksgiving, Andy, I don't even know if you noticed, I was like so tense because I decided I didn't want to tell the rest of the family about this new variant because I didn't want to freak everyone out and have everyone make sure everyone had a good Thanksgiving. But the whole time I'm like, have my phone and I'm looking and I'm like, fuck, it looks like it's getting worse. Fuck.
when you finally said it, I was like, Then the rest of my Thanksgiving was ruined. I was like, wait, and he's so worried that he's actually announcing it to the family. Oh no!
I know.
I
only made it to dessert, and then someone said something about Bavarian. I'm like, there's a new one, guys. There's a new one. I'm in trouble.
I'm so sorry to ruin this Thanksgiving, but we're an Omicron.
I was also so mad that I was somehow behind on Twitter that I didn't know about the variant yet, which is so weird.
You're like, you had variant FOMO.
I gotta give you some epidemiologists to follow on Twitter. That'll brighten your day just as much as politics.
But Andy, I know what you mean, that? Or John and both you guys, I know what you mean. Like, you click on news or even just the Apple News icon, and it's just all bad things. This person's murdered. There's new variants.
Yeah.
And I can't take it anymore. I barely read anything anymore when I know that I should, to try to educate myself and just be current. But it just, it's all crap.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. I think about that a lot because on Pod Save America, we're trying to tell, you know, educate people about politics and inspire them to take action.
I love your show, by the way.
Thank
for
you.
For a while. Yeah.
But I have to always calibrate, as does Tommy and John and Dan, like how much bad news we want to deliver. How, like, even if it's a serious topic, we try to keep it light. We try to joke around, partly just because, like, everyone gets misery from their phones or from watching the news on television. Like, if you're going to listen to it, we at least have to keep it light, or mm-hmm. else everyone's going to tune out, and I don't blame them.
I also think it goes back to what you were saying about the show that you're doing about the just the digital era. The thing is, if you really go back to how we're supposed to be living as a species, even though we're evolving, we've got to figure that one out. We wouldn't know things that were happening outside of our community. We wouldn't really, you know, we didn't have the resources. There was only so much that you could put in the newspaper. Mm-hmm. There was only so much that a news channel, like what makes the news hour, you know. Now we don't have that at all. There's not a separation. Everything
so
is
connected.
Available.
And, too connected.
And there's always a headline over and over.
Well, now our ability to know about the world's misfortune is infinite, but our ability to change it has stayed the same.
Feels mm-hmm. hopeless.
So that gap mm-hmm. has made us feel a little bit more helpless and
well, sure. And then, it's also
and then
so
you
fearful.
Have a, but you also what you have is you have a lot of loud voices, and the loud voices do not represent the amount of people out in the world who aren't loud. They're a right. small percentage. And I think that's the other thing, which is we amplify the loud voices, but we forget to listen to the solution-oriented ideas.
Well, you talked about public service. You know, you talk about sort of you want to do better, you want to do good. Essentially, that's why politicians get into it, or that's what it used to be. Now it just seems like a major power grab. Like, there's nothing about helping any constituent. It's just about staying in power however you can. I mean, in your time in politics, even though it hasn't been, you know, 50 years, but have you seen that shift from wanting to actually do something good to now just be a power play?
So I think there's been a bit of a shift. I think it's a couple things. One, the people who just want it for the title and the power are, as Kate was saying, the loudest people who get the most attention. So you hear about them more, you hear from them more than the people who are just in it for all the right reasons. And two, I think the people who would traditionally go into the job or pursue a career in politics for the right reasons are don't want to do it anymore because it seems like a fucking mess. And because you open yourself up to, like, you know, it's not just like, you have skeletons in the closet kind of thing. It's like a tweet that you know, tweeted mm-hmm. a couple years ago is going to come back to haunt you, or right. something that you said that's taken out of context is going to attack, or something you never even did, but people think you did, you know, like there's so many reasons not to put yourself into the spotlight that I think a lot of good people who otherwise would be wonderful public servants aren't going to want to serve.
Yeah. Andy, are you going to be canceled, do you think, at some point once you become super famous?
Why did you even put that out into the ether?
Now there's a target.
No, it's like an FBI. You're like back on the polygraph.
Who can find dirt on Andy? Andy's the least cancelable person I know in my life. Andy, if Andy gets canceled, then we're all canceled.
I'm surprised Oliver hasn't been canceled.
Well, I have a theory about all that. You know, because look at Howard Stern. Howard Stern has done some of the craziest shit ever, and he's untouchable because that's the persona that he has created. And so it's almost like, oh, well, he gets a pass. So the cancel culture does not, it does discriminate. You know, I mean, if you have already been that outlandish and you are a type of Howard Stern, then he gets a pass, you know?
Cancel culture, it selects for the shameless among us. And if you're shameless and you don't care and you're not going to apologize because you say fuck apologies,
right.
then eventually you just keep going.
You just keep going.
That's like, that was Trump. That's how we got Trump as president.
Are you crypto curious? Because I am. I have been for a while now. And my crypto curiosity led me to Coinbase. And I'm in. I'm all in. So Coinbase offers a trusted and easy to use platform to buy, sell, and spend cryptocurrency. It's very, very simple. They support the most popular digital currencies on the market and make them accessible to everyone. The interface is super simple. They offer portfolio management and protection. They can teach you. They've got these learning resources. There's a mobile app to make everything so simple. And you can securely monitor your crypto all in one place. At the push of a button, you know exactly what's going on. Millions of people in over 100 countries are now using Coinbase, and they trust Coinbase with their digital assets. Trust is the big word when we're dealing with cryptocurrency, and you can trust Coinbase. So whether you're looking to diversify or just get started, or you're searching for a better way to access crypto markets, start today with Coinbase. For a limited time, new users can get $10 in free Bitcoin when you sign up today at coinbase.com/sibling. So sign up at coinbase.com/sibling for $10 in free Bitcoin. Who knows what that can turn into? This offer is for a limited time only, so be sure to sign up today. That's coinbase.com/sibling.
Of all of the podcast shows that you've done about politics, what is the most sought after and desired topic from your listeners?
Like within politics?
Yeah. Like what is the thing that you think they're just, they want more of, they want to hear about more?
I actually think in the last year, actually probably through from 2020 on, is like voting rights and sort of the state of our democracy in general. Kind of this conversation we've been having where, like, are we still going to have a democracy? Like, especially after the, you know, attempted coup and the insurrection, like people want to know that where people are going to be able to vote, that they're not going to have voting restrictions, that their vote's going to count, that we're going to have people, we're going to make sure that people aren't able to steal an election again. I think that our listeners, I hear about that probably more than anything else. So I think it's sort of issue by issue.
Do you find that the Democratic Party is starting to split into two sections, ones that are more sort of traditionally libertarian and then ones that are very socialist?
I think that the Democratic Party is always a million different factions. We're like, I mean, part of the challenge is, as you know, we're fighting like sort of an extremist faction of the Republican Party. And in order to win in sort of a gerrymandered, you know, anti-majoritarian system that we have right now, you need a large majority of people in the country to vote for you as a Democrat. And so we won in 2020 only by 40,000 votes across a couple states, because that's the Electoral College, by having everyone from center-right former Republicans who voted for Mitt Romney and George W. Bush to the AOCs and the Democratic Socialists of the world. Like, they all had to be in one tent. And if we're going to keep winning elections and stave off potentially the end of democracy with another Trump presidency or something worse, we need to keep all those people in the same tent. And that's a really hard job because you have, like you said, some more people more libertarian. You have socialists, you have liberals, you have centrists, you have moderates. And like the only way we win is if we all sort of work together. And that's hard. Especially in a country this big.
You say the end of democracy, but what is that? What is that, like, hyperbolic, or are you actually, is that a real thing for you? I mean, and what does that look like, really?
Look, I don't think it looks like, you know, traditional fascism that we might know, but from history. But I do worry that if Trump runs again, which he seems like he wants to, I think he is the odds-on favorite to be the GOP nominee.
Mm-hmm. I think. What about DeSantis?
I think he will crush DeSantis because I think people love Trump. All the polls show him way, way ahead of all the rest of them. So I think unless he dies or goes to jail in a way that he can't run from jail, which is also possible, then I think he's got a very, very, very good shot at the nomination. If he's the Republican nominee, the country is polarized enough that I think we're right back to where we were in 2020, which is he is probably 30, 40, 50,000 votes away from being a president again. And I think if Trump wins again, I think the second term looks a lot worse than the first, because I think even in that first term, some of the people he had in government were not the people he really wanted in government. They weren't super loyalists. Now that all those people have left, it's only the fucking hardcore nuts that are going to be left with him in the second term. And they're going to do some scary shit. And it's not going to necessarily be like a fucking Hitler thing, but it's going to, I hope, but it's going to be you know, it'll be press freedoms degraded. It'll be starting to go after enemies, maybe using the IRS, maybe using some other government agencies. It'll be putting in place more voting restrictions so that they stay in power. Like, it'll be gradual, but it'll not be sort of the democracy that we have now or that we've known in the past. And it's going to be, I think, really hard for Democrats to win again if that happens. So it's you know, it's a challenge.
Do you miss being a part of an administration?
No. I loved what I did. I was incredibly lucky to work for Barack Obama. I think he's a once in a generation talent. I can't imagine if someone like him came along again, what I would do. Maybe, you know, I could do it again, but I was also young then. I was in my 20s and I could sleep 4 hours and work 7 days a week, and I can't do that anymore. And I think because he was so special and working for him was so special that, like, I kind of want to just put that where it was in my life. And I also just love the job that I'm doing now. I mean, it's easier than working in the White House, what I do now, for sure. But it's also very fulfilling. So I feel like I'm in, like, the best job ever.
So getting back to the brother thing real quick, and then it's then been
should,
a long time.
Yeah, and then we should do our...
But are you guys super close now? You know, are you guys still as close as you've ever were? You know,
oh, yeah.
You are.
I mean, because we... Yeah. I mean, I got one of the reasons when I left D.C., or when I left the White House and I was in D.C. and I had to figure out where to go next... a main reason that I came to Los Angeles is Andy was here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I was like,
I was pushing it too. I wanted to come.
And so I, you know, once I moved out here, then we were always close, but then we got closer. And now, you know, Emily and I see Andy and Molly and my parents, like, if not every weekend, every other weekend, because we all live.
Hey, you guys, the one thing I'm looking at my notes here that we didn't talk about, which we have to, is your news around the house when you guys were kids. And I guess my question is, do we still do the news around the house?
Andy, Emily spilled this.
Oh, my God. I was like, did they call our parents?
That would know. If they called our parents, that would be a fucking nightmare.
I want to know about that.
What is news around the house?
We have so many embarrassing stories. When we were kids, I wanted to do like a fake news. I guess I should have known then that I was going to be a podcaster. We did a fake news program called News Around the House where we had a video camera because our father bought a video camera. We were all excited. So we would set it up and do different news segments around the house. We'd do news, weather, sports, and it was just Andy and I and like one of our neighbors, and we'd run around doing it. And the tapes are somewhere, and I hope no one ever sees them.
Oh, no, you
have to find those. I guess I should have known I was going to be an actor then. I wanted
to
be an actor.
That's right, yeah. Andy was acting. I was doing that. Yeah, that was the, that was the key to our future.
Here's the thing, Ollie. If I do get canceled, it's if those tapes come out.
Wait, hold on a second. You guys, we used to make movies when we were kids.
Oh, my
not
God.
Dissimilar, but there's one called The Naked. What was it? The Naked one, where you're like the naked guy?
Oh, Butt Naked.
Butt Naked. It's called Butt Naked. like we should have known. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, we should have known
it's
really
a good,
early.
It was a great concept. The concept was,
that's a red
it was
flag
simple.
Right there.
The concept was simple. It was that when there was kids playing and they made fun of this kid and they took his clothes, he was in the pool. So he was a naked guest at this house. He runs into the house and disappears. Now we cut
so he
to
gets bullied.
20 years later and... The man living in the house was one of his best friends. And this little boy has been living naked within the walls of this house for 30 years.
30 years.
And I played the naked guy. So I had.
Of course you did.
I had braces that were all fucked up. Like this crazy hair and teeth.
And he's like running around. And there was like
running around naked.
Shots like through the window of like this naked guy running through our backyard.
I'm going to send it to you.
Wow. Yeah. No, I want to take a look at that.
Oh, my God. The videos we have. In most of them, I'm always the victim. Like, we got into real horror stuff, and I was always like the one
getting
who,
killed.
That's so funny.
I was always the one who was like, all right, guys, this is fun. Let's do our speed round because this usually isn't speedy. One word to describe the other.
This is Andy talking, and I would say empathetic.
This is John, and I would say driven.
Oh. One word to describe your relationship.
Forever.
this is John. I would say easy.
Mm. Yeah. Mm.
Good one. Good one. Damn it. I would say, this is so lame, fun.
Fun is good. I like fun.
Fun's good. Fun
who,
and easy.
Who was nerdier? We already know. It was John.
Well, I mean, it wasn't a nerd.
I mean, it depends on how you look at it. He was self-proclaimed nerd. I was pretty nerdy
until late high school.
He said it himself on the show.
He was a dork, yeah.
Who was more of a goody two-shoe?
I'd say me.
Yeah.
It is Andy talking. I still am.
Are you?
That's how you know what a goody two-shoes is, because like no one thinks of me as like the badass of the family,
right?
But I am.
Right. You are.
But I am. Yeah.
Like Andy won't even make a U-turn. Like
No.
I'm by the book.
And you failed your FBI fucking polygraph? How is this possible?
I know why, because he was trying to be good.
No,
he wants to please. He wants to please so much and be liked so much that he's lying to people.
Yeah, I wanted to tell that FBI agent that I was the biggest goody two-shoes in the world, and unfortunately it backfired.
Okay, what was the first job for each of you? Very first job.
This is Andy talking, and I still think about this job to this day because it was one of the best jobs I've ever had. I worked at Hillview Golf Course in North Reading, which was the public course. I worked there. I was like working in the cart barn, which is like, you know, pick the driving range, tool around on golf carts all day. I worked there with my best friend, Ryan Hawks, and we had the best time ever. We'd play free golf.
Mm.
We'd fuck around on the golf carts all day.
Fun.
We'd get in trouble.
Love.
And we were getting paid, and it was fantastic. Amazing. We did that all through high school.
I love that so much.
I was a cashier at CVS. It was terrible.
Not an ad. What was your first job, Ollie, other than the mailroom? Because
I didn't get paid money, but I got free entry to like fishing boats when I was working like as a pinhead on the Aquarius.
Oh, cool.
Out of Malibu, off the pier.
Nice.
I didn't get paid money, but I got to like sort of fish for free and clean the boat.
That's great. Yeah. My first job was at Bow and Arrows in Manhattan Beach.
I remember.
And it was a clothing store because I was loved my fashion. And I got, it was this tiny little store that sold like BCBG dresses.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to see lots of cute hockey players. And that was good enough for me, guys.
It works.
Okay, who has the most power in your relationship?
Whoa, that seems like...
I don't mean that in like a weird way. I mean that meaning like, if you're going to be like, we're going to dinner and someone's like, no, we're getting sushi, we're not getting Italian food, who's going to win?
I would say the our wives have the most power in both of our relationships.
Yep. Yeah, we don't... It is funny, like, when we do things together, all four of us, Andy and I don't even know that we're seeing the other one sometimes.
We
don't even know the plans.
Oh,
Emily
so
and Ollie
funny.
Just figure it all out.
Yeah. What is that in our relationship? It's kind of a weird question, isn't it?
Yeah, we don't do a lot of things like go to dinner and stuff.
No,
like,
I'm talking about power, like the power dynamic. Like a power dynamic in a sibling relationship.
I think I've found my power in the last like 6 months.
Who's the bigger daredevil?
Ooh, it's got to be Andy because I'm the least, although neither of us are much of a daredevil.
I would say neither of us.
We are both.
We
take no risks.
I love this.
Yeah.
Oh.
I guess me and some things. Not like I'm not going to like jump out of a plane or anything. But maybe I have slightly riskier behavior than Andy.
It's also funny you said that because you're like deathly afraid of flying.
Yeah, that's true. I'm also.
Oh yeah, I wanted to touch on that. I forgot to ask about that. Like, are you still afraid of flying?
I'm always. It's never stopped me from going somewhere. And I'm not that bad,
yeah,
but
I have. Yeah.
You know, I have benzos for the flight.
Yeah.
I like.
Yep.
I'm even if I take them, if it's bad turbulence, I'll be freaked out. It's not. It's not great.
So you're afraid of just plummeting 33,000 feet to the ground, basically.
Yes. Like if the plane like exploded in the air, that would be one thing. But like the idea of this
fear.
Is how I'm going to go, and I'm on a plane by myself, and it's going. That's my nightmare.
Totally. Let me ask you a question. Having a kid, how has that changed that? Has it made it worse?
It's made it, it's so funny. It's for me, it's my terror is so high that it's the same, it's constant. But Emily, my wife, she has never been afraid of flying. And now she's very afraid of flying because she's like, I can't
leave.
Yeah, she almost did the like, should we be on separate planes?
Yeah.
That's thing. How I'm that way with Danny. I don't want to be on the same plane.
No, I know. I was so together. I used to be so scared of flying. I used to take like 80 Xanax and drink a few beers. And I'd have about a good same. 5 minutes like of insanity. Like, yeah. Or my wife is like, holy shit. And then I'm like, ah, and then I'm out.
So scared. Well, but then I realized
if I did that and I have to land and work, which I last several years I've had and in the White House too, I'm like, I can't do that.
No.
So then I just couldn't do that. You know?
No, then you just got a fucking white knuckle.
White knuckle through it. Yeah.
So who was your first like celebrity crush?
It would be Kelly Kapowski on Saved by the Bell.
Yeah, so I would say so too.
Really?
I was going to say the same thing. Yeah.
Big Saved by the Bell fans in our house. We watched all the episodes.
We grew up watching Saved by the Bell. We've probably seen every episode maybe 3-4 times.
That's awesome.
Favorite book?
I don't read, so.
Favorite script.
my favorite book.
That's so hard. There's so
it's
many.
It's so hard. And I don't read that much either. I just read the news.
Guilty pleasure.
Vanderpump Rules.
Yeah, I can watch some reality TV.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Shitty TV I like. That's my
I like
player.
Shitty TV too.
Selling Sunset, that's my current.
Yeah, we've been watching.
Oh my God,
Selling Sunset,
I love Selling Sunset. Yeah. Sometimes I just put it on in the background because it's so.
Fantastic.
I've come to enjoy background TV, which is also bad, but you know.
I like Below Deck. Below Deck is.
Oh, yeah, that's good
so
too.
So good. Okay, guys, let's do the last question. Oliver's going to ask it. We always end our episodes with this, and it's a 2-part question.
Mm-hmm.
And Ollie, you go.
The first part is if looking into dealing with each other, right? If you can,
I'm forgetting the question. Why? This is so weird.
Because we haven't done a podcast in 8 months.
Okay, so it's a 2-part. So the 2-part question. The 2-part question is: what is one thing that if you could sort of alleviate from your brother, I know, but I'm going to do it.
I remembered it.
That you could alleviate from your brother that you think would actually make sort of the daily life or his life just feel that much better. What would that be that you could alleviate? The other thing is what is something that you would love to emulate?
I can tell you, this is Andy talking. I would alleviate John's Twitter account. And that would probably make his life 100 times better.
Why?
because it drives him insane. I mean,
is it just so negative all the time?
No, it's just that it consumes too much of my attention.
Right.
I should be like living more of my life.
Right.
Yeah.
Than doing it. I think for Andy, I would.
Oh wait, no. You have to do the what you want to emulate.
Oh, he does both. Great.
Yeah.
What I would emulate. Well, you know, John's a new dad and I've seen him with, Charlie, and I am not a dad yet, but I really would like to emulate, how John's been as a dad.
That's nice, Andy. I would alleviate some of Andy's anxieties. I feel like, We talked that neither of us are that big risk takers and don't have like daredevils or stuff like that. But I think that Andy could, I think if he was a little looser sometimes, he would maybe be a little.
Yeah, Molly would agree with you on that.
Molly would agree with me on that for sure. And I would emulate just how committed and driven he is. Watching him pursue acting over the last 10 years has just like always been a model for me of someone who is so committed, so hardworking, and just puts his head down and keeps going no matter what. Mm-hmm. And like, I think that's just such a
awesome.
It's a tough quality to just sort of develop on your own, but he's had it innately for so long, and it's really something to admire.
Good.
Oh, guys, wow. Cool. Thank you for coming. Right. I loved this. This was
thanks
so
for
fun.
Having
it was
us.
Good
this
catching
thanks
up.
For having
yeah,
us,
thank
guys.
You guys. This was a blast.
This was awesome.
Really
this
fun.
Great.
Sibling Revelry is executive produced by Kate Hudson and Oliver Hudson.
Producer is Allison Bresnik.
Editor is Josh Windisch.
Music by Mark Hudson, a.k.a. Uncle Mark.
If you want to show us some love, rate the show and leave us a review. This show is powered by Simplecast.
This is Amy Brown from Four Things with Amy Brown. Today, healthier is happening at CVS Health in more ways than you've ever seen. It's wellness destinations for seniors, including select locations with Oak Street Health and CVS Pharmacy. It's doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and everyone in between offering quality care and support virtually, in person, and on the phone. It's in-home evaluations through Signify Health and meeting mental health needs through Aetna. And those are just a few of the ways that healthier is happening. To see more, visit cvshealth.com/healthierhappenstogether. CVS Pharmacy, Oak Street Health, CVS Specialty, Signify Health, and Aetna are part of CVS Health. Eligibility and services vary by location and individual.
You're a growing business, which means you need every spare hour you can find. That's why the most successful growing businesses are working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens, with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Start a call instantly in huddles and ditch cumbersome calendar invites. Or build an automation with Workflow Builder to take routine tasks off your plate. No coding required. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.
Let's clear out winter and clean up the lawn with Spring Black Friday savings at the Home Depot. Right now, get the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower for just $89 and make your lawn work easier with a powerful 90 miles an hour of clearing power. And with convenient online shopping, you can order on the app, pick up in store, and get outside sooner. Get your yard spring ready with the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower, now just $89 during Spring Black Friday at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.